Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Boom! Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. We are at
Sullivan Dental Partners.
Sullivan Dental Partners waiting room, which we are in. Gosh, we need a bigger... In the new office, I promise you, we will build a badass studio.
We should.
It will be insane.
Millennial Dentist.
Fantastic episode coming your way, everybody. Tons of guests in the house. Big things happen. It's a busy week
around
here.
It's a busy week for you.
Blake with Implant Compare.
Yes.
Round two.
Round two, yes. You had him back in like two months ago.
I saw him.
And our two of my favorite periodontists in the world. I have Dr. Israel Putterman from Washington.
Dr. P.
D.C. And we have Matthew. Well, he goes by Phenodonics.
So it's not, we're setting the record straight. It's not Phenodonics.
It is not Phenodontic.
And it's not Puderman.
And it is not
Puderman.
Perfect.
Well, that we've accomplished a lot already.
we're done.
One of the most popular guys on Instagram. Everyone knows how to actually say his name now. This is fantastic.
No, but so honestly, these are two of the most talented folks. I feel like every time I see their pages, it's like I feel like, man, their hand skills got to be so on point. And what is their secret? So today we have this episode, talk about their secret, talk about their journey. I'm so excited. I kind of know these guys. I've actually had a pleasure and a blessing of being able to see them a couple weeks ago in person. They had a course and they're going to go over that more. They're going to talk about their courses. But let's start with you, man, Israel.
All right. So thanks for having me. Thanks for having us. It's going to be a fun time. We're looking forward to it. And so, you know, you want the story of how I got into dentistry and all of that stuff.
Yes.
It's a bit convoluted. It's not a great straight arrow story, but basically it's, and Matt's laughing because everything's convoluted with me, but, you know, I wanted to be a physician, and at a certain point, I didn't want to take the MCAT. And so I say, you know what, if I don't want to take the MCAT, then I guess maybe dentistry is the way to go. And actually, a buddy of mine up in Montreal, where I grew up, Wade Boroff, if you ever listen to this, Wade, my man, he's a general dentist now. He was always going into dentistry, and he was my buddy, and he was doing it. And I said, you know what, that looks pretty good. Why don't I try that? So it's funny, I actually went to my wife's general dentist at the time and just to shadow him for the day to see what he does. And I saw him do a cleaning. And believe it or not, I had to sit down because I almost fainted after seeing the blood from the cleaning. And, you know, here I am doing perio. So I went to dental school in Boston, BU, and had a good time. It's a good school, and Boston's a good city. And then once I was leaving that, I was torn on what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to do prost or oral surgery, or I even thought endo for a second.
Were you a gunner like out of the gate? Like in
no, gotta be. He gotta be. Look at him. He's Boston University. Kidding me?
Yeah, it's true.
I was looking at y'all's grade. I was like, there's Boston. No way I could ever get into Boston. Let's just not apply.
I must have greased some hands or something, but I knew nothing about dentistry when I was in dental school. All of my buddies, they all came in knowing exactly what they wanted to do. And I knew nothing at all. I didn't know what a root canal was until my third year of dental school. I knew nothing about it.
And I still don't know what it is.
but you know, I graduated from dental school with one thing saying I would never be a periodontist.
Is that because, why is that?
That is the same thing as our school.
And I'm curious to know, is it because of just your undergrad experience?
Yeah, it totally was. So no offense to the BU Perio department, but and the grad with Sharif Saeed and all of them, grad program is pretty good, but the pre-doc dental school, you know, I didn't have a great perio experience. I didn't love it. And I shadowed in an awesome perio practice up north of Boston with Gary Reiser and Myron Nevins and that gang. And so had some really cool sort of mentors, but I still, I didn't see it. I didn't want to do it. And only after getting out of there and went to Loma Linda to do an implant residency did I realize that I got into perio.
So you, upon graduating dental school,
yeah.
How long was the time between that and residency? You went straight into that?
No, I actually worked in one of these chains in Boston called Gentle Dental.
Oh, yeah.
Gentle Dental. For 3 months. And the one thing that I learned is that I never wanted to do, I couldn't do general dentistry. I just couldn't do it. I didn't have, I needed to, I felt bad about placing a crown because I wanted to redo it 10 times. I was too anal about it. And I'm somebody who needs to know everything about a very small, narrow field to feel comfortable.
So Matt, let's jump over to you because I want to kind of bring you up to speed to where he's at. So he's in residency now. Talk about your early, you know, dental career and what got you there.
Yep.
You know, I was kind of giggling a little bit because actually, you know, me and Israel have never really talked about this, but and we are good friends, but it, very similar sort of story. You know, I always wanted to be either a physician or a dentist. I knew nothing about dentistry. My dad was a physician. And I was basically studying for the MCAT. And he looked at me and he said, listen, don't be a doctor just because I'm a doctor. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do with my life. And he said, well, you're very good with your hands. You love, you know, I used to like take things apart and try to put them back together. And he said, why don't you go hang out with my buddy who's a periodontist. And that periodontist is amazing. Was an amazing periodontist. I watched him do 2 or 3 implants in, you know, a 2-hour period. I was like, this is pretty cool. Like, what else do dentists do? You know, and then that periodontist sent me to the office of a world-class oral surgeon down in Miami. And so I hung out with him for the day and I saw him doing tissue grafts and taking out wisdom teeth. And, you know, before I knew it, I said, oh, this is for me. I want to be a dentist. I apply to dental school, start dental school. And then I learn, wait a second, I got to do all this other dentistry stuff. In the meantime, I got to learn how to prep teeth and I got to learn how to carries control. And Israel's story with you know, pre-doc perio is very true. You know, we do a lot of diagnosing and deep cleanings and it's not very enticing. Luckily for me, I did have that experience out in the real world shadowing an amazing periodontist. So, you know, I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. So when I graduated, I went right into perio, went to Nova Southeastern University to do perio. And, you know, of course, there was plenty of ups and downs along the way, you know, where you kind of doubt yourself and you think, should I be doing this? Should I have gone to be an oral surgeon or should I have gone to be an orthodontist like everybody and their grandmother tells you to do? But of course, you know, you stick it out and, you know, I'm very happy with the decision I made. And just like, you know, all of you guys can attest, there's good days and bad days, but you really have to love what you do. So, you know, luckily, you know, both Israel and myself kind of found the niche that we were very, you know, happy to be a part of. So it worked out.
So my first question then kind of finishing off some of this to the degree of the kind of the early getting into perio is, you know, it's such a common theme. Y'all experienced it. We both experienced it that undergrad perio or pre, you know, that is just not that fun. And it kind of has a bad, and I don't think that's I don't think that the three schools we went to are the only ones that are like that. So my question to y'all as periodontists is that something we should be doing differently? Like, should the curriculum be changing? Do you think that the basis that it is now is what it should be? Is that just part of it? Talk a little bit about that because I think there are a lot of our listeners who are young, you know, either dental students and are like, gosh, I hate perio, but perio not talking about all the time. Like if there was something we would go back to, it'd probably be perio.
Oh my God, man. I lost so much respect in dental school and then I gained that respect on Instagram. And then I was like, are you kidding me? You could do all of this being a periodontist? And then I started clinically seeing, man, this perio thing was a lot more than I thought it was.
It is. So y'all speak to that a little bit.
You have that dichotomy where you have, you know, the oral medicine side of perio, which is very interesting to some people, but, you know, clinically, it's not very exciting. And then, of course, you know, you have all these very intricate procedures and the ability to, you know, manipulate soft tissues. And I used to always laugh when I hear people say periodontal plastic surgery. But you know, that's a branch of periodontics. And of course, you know, there's a huge overlap between oral surgeons and periodontists. And, you know, we can have the argument, you know, who's trained to do implants and go that route. But, you know, the bottom line is it's dependent on the person, right? So, anybody who has the training and who has the will and, you know, takes it upon themselves to try to master something. You know, what Israel said is very true. I'm the type of person, I want to master one thing. I don't like the idea of not really knowing what I'm doing. So for me, perio worked well because I was able to sort of focus, you know, on that one thing and try to really wrap my head around it as opposed to trying to be the jack of all trades, you know?
Sure.
The dental students, you know, would benefit from shadowing. I mean, that's, you know, and I spent some time in the undergrad clinic shadowing some of the residents, you know, while I was an undergrad. And that was helpful, but you really don't get the full scope. You know, you don't get the full scope until you're really in the trenches.
You don't. I mean, even at BU, when we would shadow the perio residents, at most they'd be doing a crown lengthening. You know, all the departments, they had an implant department, they had perio, they had oral surgery, and they'd all be fighting over the implant cases. And in that school, I think from what it was at the time, perio was kind of lowest on the totem pole. And so they just have the really basic cases. You know, you look at what they do in dental school and orthodontics. Ortho is kind of known as a department that doesn't teach pre-doc much at all because they don't want the dentists to know. They want to keep it secret. Exactly.
Well, you know what that is, though? I'm sorry to interrupt, but that is hurting their profession more and more they do it. And look at the Smile Direct. Or look at, I mean, let's not get political. but to a point, think about it. Ortho is one of those things that's never talked about because let me take care of it. But if I know more, maybe I could help you more.
Yeah, that's the big dichotomy. And you know, perio might be better like that. I don't know. Or maybe it just looks too easy and so everybody thinks that they can do it. I don't know. You make it look too easy, Perio.
No. I love, the more we do and the more I do, I feel like the more there is to learn about this thing. And that's why I wish I had that opportunity, the more I learn about it. But now I have to, unfortunately, take off office and go and learn, which is fun because I keep doing it. I love to. Even if you guys do the second, you guys need to do a continuum. And we're going to talk about this, their course. But the thing is that the clinical aspect of what are all the things that we could do for our patients instead of pulling things, and sometimes it doesn't really have to end up being an implant. You know, let's just be real, some of these teeth could last a lot longer that we are now aggressively trying to treatment plan. Everybody's pulling and doing all on four on a 40-year-old patient where we're thinking, okay, are these our implants are going to last forever, putting 9mm implants for, I mean, how long is this gonna, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more to the story where I feel like learning the clinical aspect now a lot helps more. What do you guys think? I mean,
I think a lot of it's too, though, it's clinician specific, right? What they believe in, what they can save, right? A lot of guys will go, well, I could battle this, but I probably won't win the battle. And, you know, let's just settle with what I know. And I've been doing all on fours. You know, I did 50 arches last year. I'll just stick with that, go that route.
See, that's the thing, the paradigm shift that I think it needs to be a little bit slower on the mindset of, and I'm saying it, and I'm one of those biggest ones to blame for. I mean, I was a victim of thinking of all on four every day, right? Like full arches, how many I've done this month versus next month. But now the more I'm getting wiser, I think I'm learning that, hey, these things are like could last a lot longer if with a good treatment planning, some of these teeth.
Well, I think there's two big aspects that I see that will hinder me a lot of time, or what I think hinder a lot of young dentists or students is, one, I don't think we're trained in dental school to come out with an educated, like now our education really starts. Like, I think that we are, to some degree, it's like, go get them, you know? And as a general dentist, then all of a sudden you're expected to kind of do something and you'll go take a weekend course. Well, that weekend course is it's geared to make money and make you successful. So like they kind of throw you into the fire and show you, well, then you do one or two and then you get, you know, and so I think there's a part of it is we stop, most people on average stop their education. You know, that's problem number one.
100%.
What was problem number two?
Problem number one is a good one. And I think you should stop right there.
We'll stop there.
What about you? So where are we at right now? Let's go back. We got into clinical.
Well, Matt's adding something though.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I think a big thing that, you know, all of us, we graduate dental school, we think that we know everything. And then you go to work that first day. And it's the same thing with perio. You graduate perio, you think you're an expert. And then you go to work the first day and you have a problem or something you've never seen. And all real learning is done, you know, on the job. I mean, I remember in my dental school interview, the dean of Columbia University said to me, there's not a single thing that you're going to learn in school that you're going to use in real life. And I thought he was exaggerating, but he wasn't exaggerating. I mean, I only graduated, it was 2006, but there's very few techniques that I was doing in school that we're actually doing in real life. So, you know, you learn on the job. That's really the way of the world. But when you look at, you know, periodontists, and I think what we're trained to do in school that I think gives us an edge is treatment plan these bigger cases. Because I remember, you know, working as a general dentist for a couple of months, kind of, you know, moonlighting when I was in perio, before I really understood the full scope of how to treat and find these big cases, was that, you know, it's very intimidating. A patient comes in, they have problems everywhere in their mouth. And you want to be the guy that just focuses on one tooth at a time. And, you know, this patient's never going to finish treatment. By the time you finish one area, the other area starts to bother them again. Or do you want to kind of look at the full scope? And I think that's what, you know, periodontists can kind of bring to the table is this, you know, idea of us being the quarterbacks of the case to sort of plan things out. I mean, there's a lot of cases that get referred to me that I don't end up even treating, but I know I'm helping the patient because I'm giving them a roadmap, you know? And in terms of doing these all on four cases, I mean, I just did one today and it was an amazing day. I was using tips that I learned from Payray during the surgery. And, you know, we placed, you know, thousands of implants. Israel does, you know, thousands and thousands of implants. I do try to shy away from those big cases, especially what like Payray was talking about in these 40-year-old patients. I mean, you're going to remove all that bone. You're going to place six implants. It's going to look amazing. But then what do you do 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road? Now when they have a problem, how do you go back and fix that? And, you know, the idea is to not do anything that's, you know, irreversible. And listen, a lot of these cases that it's an indication. A lot of these patients don't have a choice. And we don't have a choice. That might be the best treatment option, but it is important, you know, before we go that route to figure out, or at least, you know, contemplate or give the patient, you know, the different alternatives on what it takes to actually save teeth. It can be done, but it is hard. You know, I'll frequently tell patients that, you know, there's an easy way and there's a hard way. You know, patients have to be on board with saving teeth. They have to be on board with maintenance and home care. So there's a big equation there. It's not just, you know, take out teeth and do implants or, you know. So I think that's where periodontists, I think, really have an edge, or where our training teaches us is to sort of see the big picture and try to quarterback the case a little bit.
Yeah, you know, there's always a pendulum. And people talk about that in the perio world, about the pendulum swinging. 10, 15 years ago, swung way over, maybe too far over to the implant side, and now slowly swinging back into periodontist trying to back to saving teeth rather than taking teeth out. And I always talk to patients, and I use this expression a lot, like taking out a tooth is always, always a choice. It's always a choice. There's never a time where you're going to wake up, and even if the tooth has class 3 mobility, the tooth is not going to be on your pillow when you wake up. So it's always a choice to remove it. And it's about making that choice. And whether you want to do that or you don't want to do that, there are always going to be alternatives. And to some people, it's a no-brainer to take out the tooth because it's going to lead to maybe less time in the dental chair. And other people say, I don't care about less time in the dental chair. I want to save my tooth. And that's totally fine, too. It's always a choice by the patient.
No, and that's so important too for young dentists to realize when treatment planning standpoint is if you can let the patients take ownership of their problems and help make the decisions, gosh.
The whole concept of co-discovery, co-diagnosis, co-everything.
That'll dig you out of so many holes.
Don't let me be the dentist.
Amen.
Let us be the dentist. You know, why are you going to blame this on me? I always put it on patient's plate because it is not my fault. It's your fault at the end.
Yeah. I talk to them about, you know, the decision to remove a tooth or not, about it depends on their psychology. If they're the type of person who wants to try things and have it, let's say it fails in 2 years or 5 years, whatever it is. And I say to them, if you're the type of person who's going to be upset that it failed, you only got 2 or 5 years out of it, then I suggest doing the implant now. But if you're the type of person who wants to give it a try, and if it doesn't work in 2 to 5 years, you go to the implant and you say, great, I got 2 to 5 years out of it, then I say save the tooth. But that's your decision.
That's a great point.
And one thing I like to say, and I think this has a lot to do with everything we do daily, and I don't know why there's not enough of that. When people go on talk on podiums, big podiums, Matt, you tell me, and you guys like share your opinion about this fact that the more that I'm seeing these, it's really the patient demographics is that is dictating a lot of that mindset for dentists. For example, a lot of the dentists that get out and work in an area where, for example, they're, most of these patients are more out to financially, they can't afford these things. So what are the mentality?
Expensive to save teeth.
Correct. So mentality for this dentist that is 30-year-old getting out of school, thinking all the time that, well, the money's the thing, money's the thing, money's the thing. So then they automatically get trained on that mindset. Now, unfortunately, that's for some people. Then we have another group of people. And Israel, I know because, for example, your demographics are some of the people that you said it, like, I love for you to kind of pitch in more on the demographic of his patients, because some of those patients, there's no way that, for example, in my office, or I'm not saying me, because I'm actually in Nashville, like in a midtown where is, I think most of my patients are pretty wealthy. However, when I could definitely see the corporate where I was, where this mentality was so different, that would affect my mind at the end of the day. And that kind of made me sometimes be affected by the decision that maybe it's just
almost like what you're treatment planning or what you're proposing.
Yes. The whole environment, yeah, you know, totally that agree. Environment factor, how it's affecting me with the ways that I'm thinking, my subconscious mind, you know?
And we've all been surprised with those cases that come in and you think there's no way they're going to go for this elaborate
sure.
treatment plan.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, that's a big mistake we make is to you know, label
Judge.
Patients before we really give them the information. But at the same time, you know, we're all living that in the real world, you know, and I have, you know, 4 or 5 different offices and the demographics of each of those offices is so different. And so, you know, I have certain offices where, you know, all I'm doing all day long is connective tissue grafts on teenagers and, you know, clinical crown lengthening, aesthetic crown lengthening, and other offices where it's like, you know, full overdentures and full arches, you know, every week. So that it's certainly, that's the real world. But obviously, you shouldn't put yourself into that box.
So how would you, how would that, for example, when you go to that demographic, whenever you said that right now, how would you come up when the patient walks in? What are your treatment options when you go to that room versus the other room in another? Like, how would that not affect you thinking of the case? Because you only have a short period of time trying to treatment plan a case that, you know what I mean? Sometimes I feel like we're just so, we don't have everything that we want. Like, we don't have everything helping us,
you know,
come up.
I think you're doing your patient a disservice if you don't give them all the options. I mean, we all try to give them the most, you know, efficient. I always use the word efficient, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat, but you want to be efficient about it. If it's going to require me to do osseous surgery and a guided tissue regeneration, that's going to cost the patient $2,500, you know, for a procedure that maybe has a 50% success rate, you know, we can give them that option. But like Israel mentioned, you know, let them know that there's no guarantee. They have to have ownership in it. But I think it is important to let them make that decision. You know, we shouldn't put ourselves in that situation where we're making decisions for patients. Especially because we don't know the outcome. Some patients do great with implants, some patients don't. And same thing with periosurgery. Periosurgery is very hard. It's hard. It's probably the hardest procedure that I do on an everyday basis. And I mean, osseous surgery is just not fun for anybody.
Well, I didn't even do it. I've even referred osseous surgery out to other periodontists.
You know,
I'm not even joking.
I've been referring LANAPs out, because, yeah, you know, patients that need osseous, and I know a great dentist down the street that uses a LANAP. And I'll say, you know what? This is a great case for LANAP. Go see my buddy and come
just
back in
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Talk about LANAP. Can you guys, actually, this is a good one because it's getting more and more popular. Can you say that? What is that? Just for some people that hear this for the first time.
I don't think anybody's hearing this for the first time, but it's laser assisted new attachment protocol, I think it is.
Lineup.
And, you know, geez, we could talk for 2 hours just on this alone. Neither Matt or I use Lineup, but, you know, it is very popular and it is gaining steam and there is some good data on it. It's kind of confusing. I mean, the whole point of it is just to be able to gain new attachment without having the recession involved with pocket elimination surgery, pocket reduction surgery. And you're supposed to be able to regenerate connective tissue attachment and everything's hunky-dory. But, you know, the histology that's been shown from what I remember when I looked at the literature, and maybe it's different now, but there is some good histology, but it's on single-rooted teeth. And I don't know about you guys, but most of the periodontal disease that I see is not on single-rooted teeth. It's on molars. And when you have molars, the data was really not great from what I remember seeing. So there's no question it has its application, but in my hands, I didn't think that it was
ultimately, it's just very appealing because of how difficult pocket reduction surgery is.
Yeah.
And Israel mentioned the recession that you get. For us, we get a great result if a patient comes back and they have no pocketing, and then they look at their teeth and they say, why am I long in the tooth? So it's like sometimes those cases just feel like it's a lose-lose. No matter how great the surgery outcome is, the patient's never going to be satisfied. And so if there is another way, I think that's why so many people have jumped on the bandwagon, because if there's another way, even if it's not 100% predictable, you know, I don't know if I disagree that it's worth a shot. You know, if there's a way to do it without causing as much pain, discomfort, agony, and then, you know, getting a better aesthetic outcome, you know, we know we're killing bacteria when we're using the laser. So
the data does show that it's pretty similar to scaling and root planing alone.
Yeah. I mean, and scaling and root planing works. We know that too, right? Yeah. We know scaling and root planing works.
So what keeps y'all from obviously, you know, y'all are very well to do, very apparent on everything. I mean, y'all are up to date on all this stuff. What keeps y'all from like taking that course, jumping into it to see, you know, what it would do differently in your hands when you did it?
It's too easy for them.
Honestly, I just, that's not my area of expertise and interest, even though I'm a periodontist. I get that for sure. I focus my practice. I mean, you could say anything, plastic surgery, but then you have the boob guys and the nose guys. And
Right. That makes total sense.
I'm grafting and implants. That's what I do. I don't tend to do a lot of periodontal disease.
Sure. That makes total sense. That's a good reason right there.
Now, do you think is that something that is dying, just to be blunt honest, or what?
Well, it can. I mean, eventually someone has to do it.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it. But by the same token, you're right. It's either moving into Lineup or it's moving into implants. And fewer and fewer people are really talented at osseous pocket reduction surgery. And it's a shame because it's a good modality. And like I said, I refer people out for that who really, I think, would benefit from it. But more and more people have to be trained on it. And it's a really tough thing to do. Like Matt said, to do two quads of it or four quads of it, I mean, it's strenuous and it's detailed. And I could place 1,000 implants and not be as tired as I am.
The ROI is just not, from that. You know, and what's funny is we've seen the exact same thing happen in oral surgery to some degree. I mean, we have most oral surgeons or students that want to be oral surgeons want to do two things, wisdom teeth and implants.
Right? Exactly.
And so like no one's going into hospitals. No one's wanting to
like, do like, what is that? There are more. Yeah, it's so true, man. Like I'm getting so many of these messages from oral surgeons alone. Like I'm getting more and more followers from some of these specialists that they're like, dude, how many implants are you doing? And I'm seeing their records. They've gone through MD. Some of them are MD, DDS, but they really don't want to be in a hospital setting. I'm like, dude, why'd you do all of this? Look at the Beverly Hills. Some of them are living now in Beverly. Like, why? I want to just do implants.
Well, and shoot, I have endodontists in town placing implants now.
One of my good buddies is endodontist. I think he places more implants than I do.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a very interesting dichotomy of time where, you know, the traditional specialty is what they were built on is everything's getting muddier. And we are getting, like you said, Israel, we're getting more niche specialists where we are like our medical counterparts, where we're seeing more, okay, I'm going to be the osteosurgery guy, or I'm going to be the implant guy, or I'm the gingival graft guy. And so it is really interesting from that standpoint.
So we talked about, let's just go flashback as far as what we covered, because I think we're going back to Israel's now starting his implant journey in Loma Linda.
We did. We got, we're way off task there.
Can I sidetrack?
Yeah. We got a little sidetracked, but I love for him. I want him to talk about a little bit about his demographics now, yes. But can you kind of go briefly from finishing up school? How did you end up there in that practice? And then I want the math to say the same thing. Like, he's got a very cool, unique practice set up. I want to know.
Okay. So, so there I was practicing in Gentle Dental in Boston.
Which wasn't too gentle.
I will never get over the name Gentle Dental.
It wasn't too gentle with him.
it wasn't so gentle with me. And actually, don't mention my name with them because I left a bit of a...
We're not going to mention your name with Boston University.
But we are mentioning
with a lot of people.
The title of this episode may be called Gentle Dental.
Gentle Dental with the two pins.
Yeah. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought about doing PROS. I thought about doing perio. I thought about doing oral surgery. And then I found out, and none of them really appealed to me. And then I found out about Loma Linda Implant Dentistry Program. And it's 3 years, and it's a full residency, full-time, three-year intense residency, where it's all about implants. And you do the restorative, you do the surgical, and you do even the lab work involved with it. You do lab work on all your cases. And I thought, wow. And I looked that up and looked online and saw Jaime Lozada and Joe Kahn and all of these guys who publish a ton. And I'm like, wow, this is not just fly-by-night residency program. The residency program's over 30 years old. They were doing implants when implants were considered malpractice. And, you know, so I looked at that, and somehow I luckily got into that program. And I went out to California and started that. And then I was in my second year of residency when I spoke to one of my faculty who was a periodontist there. And, speaking to him more and more, he went through the implant program and then did perio afterwards, but maybe 15 years before me. And I thought, wow, you know, if I'm going to do 3 years of post-grad, I'm going to come out being a general dentist who knows a crap load about implants, but it's going to be a tough sell to tell people that I didn't just take a weekend course and, you know, I did a full residency. So, and then at the same time, I really wanted to know much, much more about the soft tissue side of things. I knew how important that was with the implant cases. And so went over to the perio department and asked them if I could combine things. And so they said, yeah, for an extra 2 years, I did perio too. So stuck around there, got the implant certificate, did perio certificate. And so I was there for 5 years and then said, I'm out of California, get out. And I was always planning to go to Manhattan, and the practice I was talking to there for a few years on Park Avenue, you know, a good practice. It was 2008, and that was the financial crisis in New York. And, you know, they told me that they're feeling the pinch. It was... obviously, the whole city was feeling the pinch. And they said, you're welcome to come, but just for you to know, the city's kind of hurting right now. So I said, holy crap, I can't go to Manhattan when everybody's hurting and tell everybody, here I am, the 10,000th periodontist on my block, and everybody should come to me. So we looked at all the other places in the country that I would move to. Me and my wife were doing an intense internet search on a few different cities. And you know, Washington, D.C. looked pretty enticing. So I looked online at a great economy. You know, I figured the government doesn't go into recession. And looked online, and there was a practice that was looking for an associate. And came out here, interviewed with them. They offered me the job. And here I am. And that didn't work out, obviously. And then was going to buy another practice downtown D.C. And that guy wasn't truly ready to sell. And then I opened up on my own 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
So talk about the development of your practice from going as you...
We're going to talk about...
He's dying to hear about this. Talk about that.
No, because he talked about it in the school. I mean, the school. And he talked about it in the class.
I mean, it's Washington, D.C. you know, all the people you see on TV and politics, they all need dentists and they go to dentists here. They're here for a certain amount of time. So, yeah, well, you know, it's nothing special about my practice. Everybody here sees their share of quote unquote political celebrities. And, you know, it's pretty cool. Everybody, they always teach you not to talk, what is it, sex, religion, and politics with your patients. Everybody here talks politics.
That's all they want to talk about.
That's all they want to talk about. It's like being in Beverly Hills and saying, don't talk about, you know, Hollywood. Well, come on. How do you not talk about it? So it is pretty cool. I mean, definitely some of my patients, they all have their own sort of unique needs because they're on TV or because of travel and all sorts of things. But, you know, that's not everybody. That's a small segment of the practice. It's just a cool little perk of living in Washington, D.C.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty neat.
Okay, so no, one of the cool thing was he had some graphs and some plots. That's what I think he got the story was. That's what I wanted to.
Oh, okay, let's hear the story.
Are you going to pull it up?
Yeah, because that was kind of neat. Well, he had some percentage that was very, very interesting. But while he's pulling that up, Matt, can you tell us your story now that after you got out of school and what are you doing and all of that?
Well, you know, I'm down in South Florida. So when I graduated also, you know, it was 2009. It was the financial crisis. You know, all these old timers that, you know, you'd expect to be able to buy a practice from were not, you know, selling because it was not a good time. And a couple guys that were years older than me in residency said, listen, just go around, get yourself a job working for General Dentist. That's what everybody's doing. So, you know, I came out of school and I started talking to different people that I knew. And before I knew it, I had like, you know, 15, 20 offices I was working for. And it was crazy. It was too much. I couldn't really, you know, focus my attention at each of the offices. So, you know, after about a year or two of just kind of pulling my hair out, I basically said to a couple of the offices that I, you know, had a good relationship with, I said, listen, let's build a perio practice out of these offices as opposed to just being, you know, the implant guy that comes in once a month. Let's do it, you know, 1.5 days a week. And, you know, I got very lucky. I turned, you know, 3 or 4 of those 15 offices into, you know, basically, you know, a perio practice within a specialist office, within a general dentist office. So, you know, I kind of pride myself that I don't really work for any franchise office, you know, franchises, you know, like Israel had, you know, talked about. You know, that works for some people. Some people love that. And I'm not, you know, putting it down because, you know, we need dentists working at those offices. You know, there are a lot of patients that are in need of care. But for me, I wanted to be able to really, you know, give my patients more attention. And, you know, rather than doing 15 surgeries a day, you know, if I could do 3 or 4 good ones, and that's always my goal, you know, to do 3 or 4 good ones a day and take my time and treat patients the way I'd want to be treated. And so I've sort of been able, you know, afforded myself the ability to do that in the last couple of years by sort of building, you know, and focusing on those 3 or 4 offices that, you know, I was the most happy at. And, you know, I always have fantasies of opening my own practice. And eventually maybe I will, maybe I'll move up to, DC and team up with Israel one of these days. But,
guys, you know, tell me,
you know, that's the interesting thing about, you know, dentistry in general right now. Things are really changing. I mean, it really is the Wild West in terms of, you know, this Instagram and Facebook and just seeing what other people are doing. I think the biggest mistake that most of us make when we get out of school, we go all climb into our little black cave, you know, our little black hole. And we're completely like cut off from the real
isolated from what's going on in the real world.
Right. And that's why, you know, that's why I started to get involved with Instagram, because I just love being able to, you know, talk to guys like Israel and Ere and be able to say, what are you guys doing on an everyday basis? What are you doing about this case? It kind of reinvigorated.
Like, I can't say enough about how much when I honestly like the skill level or some of the techniques that he's using and Israel both using has made me want to learn this so much more, to where I bought some of the books like Otto Zor's book, where I read some of those over the week. Just like I'm like, dude, this guy's suturing technique is like crazy. Like you, I'm looking at his surgery. Maybe if he posts one up, like one day post-op, it's like nothing has happened.
Wow.
And how can I make my suturing like cool? So I'm going to his course here in Florida and learning it because I love to learn hands-on. I'm more of a hands-on kind of guy, but I like to learn the science behind it too, like read some of these textbooks. But honestly, it's been helping me, I think, making my surgeries even better. And that's shout out to you guys for doing that and posting it so selflessly, because that takes a lot of documentation. I mean, let's be honest, Soli. I mean, you know how much that mirror gets foggy? How much that mirror gets foggy? And I'm looking at my assistant like, no. I get mad. I'm like, dude, I need another assistant. So I get sometimes three assistants for one photo. And next thing I know,
my assistants, do they stop on my case? They're about to kill me.
Okay, will be live streaming.
Faster surgery
one
would go if I didn't have to take pictures.
Right. In surgery with him, he's got usually like one phone in one hand and he's live streaming on Instagram. He's got a camera in the other hand. You know, I don't. He's got his toes. He's using to place the implant. Yeah, you know?
I know it's tough.
But I think you have to disrupt yourself and your workflow in order to do so. Because 100%. I mean, the photos you guys do. I talk to the companies all the time, and they are begging to get content like this. They die to try to get good photography and good product placement and stuff
talk
like
about,
that.
Yeah, some of their surgeries. How do you get that type of a shot and consistent basis with the same angle going 9 months? This is the pre-op. This is the same angle. I'm like, this is beautiful. I don't even see textbooks like it.
Well, and I say it every day. Instagram makes me a better dentist. I mean, it's funny, but like it truly is, because I'm like, crap, I can't post this. Like everybody's gonna give me crap about it. And I mean, gosh,
you're not like me putting.
I posted one the other day. It was a great root canal, but the picture I put doesn't have rubber dam on it. Oh my gosh. Man. You would have thought I was burning down Rome. Like the endo folks just came out of the woodwork. Yeah. I mean, it was like, and I was like, oh, and I was like, gosh, good point. I mean, okay, sorry.
So what, you is know, rubber down?
It's funny, I know. But anyways, but it does. It makes
The pictures are extremely valuable, and not only for us in documenting with our patients, but since I've really started, you know, taking good pictures and really focusing on the documentation, I become a better dentist. I mean, you can go back and look at your cases from a year ago, 2 years ago. I mean, and I laugh when I go back and look at cases, that photos I took 5 years ago, and I say to myself, you know, what was I doing here? And then you see the results and you say, okay, now I know how I could have done it differently. If you're not taking photos, I mean, we're all doing hundreds of or thousands of cases a year. I mean, think of all that knowledge you're just throwing in the garbage if you're not really paying attention. You can go back and look at the note and you say, oh yeah, I used a particular bone graft and XYZ membrane, but you're not seeing how you did the surgery. And, you know, a picture obviously says 1,000 words. So for me, the pictures are everything.
How did you guys get your photo skills?
You don't show them, you don't do anything with them. Sometimes they're just going back and reviewing, scrolling through your pictures just teaches you so much.
I was asking, how did you both get your photography skills? Because right now, every dentist is texting me right and left, hey, I want to learn photos. I want to learn photography. So I'm actually, before I forget, Miguel Ortiz coming in Nashville. We're going to have him.
Dad's
to
going.
Do a,
I'm going.
He's coming. We're going to have him on the podcast in September.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So he's going to be on our podcast. He's actually going to be on a DIA, which we're going to get to later on, maybe like a few minutes, just talk about what we're going to do at DIA to get more folks excited about it. Because I know both of you guys are coming, correct?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. But how did you guys both end up, like, because your photography has, gosh, been like crazy good.
Well, I think we both have a little different story. I mean, Israel's photographs are incredible. So he let him tell you his story.
I mean, like Matt and everybody else who goes through residency, and, you know, we're all sort of very, very picky and particular about our pictures. And having Joe Kahn as my mentor, he's also taking amazing pictures. And so photography has always been an interest. And I've always taken the pictures, just never really done much with them. They sit in my computer. And then posting them to Instagram, you start to see things differently. And you see these people that are just taking unbelievable pictures. And I'm saying, well, I want to learn how to do that. And so last year, year and a half ago or so, I sent my staff, two of my assistants, to the When Pictures Really Matter course.
Oh, yeah, Eduardo.
Jesus and Ed.
Yeah.
Jesus, yeah.
Two of my assistants there, because I couldn't make the course. And they came back with all sorts of tips and tricks, and they came back with the light boxes and everything.
Light boxes.
It's that's not the shooter, it's the arrow.
You give them the credit card, and they come back with all this gear.
So I started to use that, and then I said, well,
yeah.
Like, okay, that's really cool, and things are really good, but I got to go myself, too. So here I was a year later, and that's when Matt and I first met in person. What was it, 2 months ago or so, at the When Pictures Really Matter course in New York. And it was actually a really cool group. There were some really cool people in there. Met some Insta friends. And
Adamo, did you guys see Adamo there?
Yeah, Adamo was there. Ben Johnson.
Andy.
Moms.
Oh, yeah, they'll all be at DIA.
Yeah, Andy, because we're going to have all those folks at the DIA meeting here next in December. So super excited.
I actually just stayed at Jesus's flat in Madrid, Spain.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, he was coming to New York to teach the course. He's like, here,
super
have my keys.
Talented folks, so super awesome. Talented and very humble.
Awesome. Yeah, they're great guys. They really are. Take the
course.
I love
it. I love it because you can go. I was in New Mexico there a week for a thing, and then bump in and go have dinner with the Dietrichs. You know,
nice, yes.
It's so it's
they
cool
take some go, great photos they too. They're photos. Very creative. I love their concepts like Thrive Bioesthetics.
But they do, but yeah, it's fun because you end up having someone in every city. Okay, I want to turn this conversation a little bit to. I want to get a little clinical with it. Because we have way too much talent up here to not
talk about suture.
For me not to try to extract something here to learn. So I want y'all to take it away. Let me, Israel, Matt, why don't y'all talk about what's something really cool that you're excited about right now and what you're doing, and maybe kind of share a little bit about that, maybe individually.
For me, we talked about, we all kind of go in our little cave and we start doing certain procedures more than others. And we all have our we're a collection of our own experiences. So, one of my passions has always been, regeneration, bone grafting, tissue grafting. I was always very...
good at it.
But he's passionate about it.
All right.
Exactly. I was just passionate. I just, honestly, though, I just really wanted to be good at it. I mean, I remember being in Perio and learning about, bone grafting. I didn't even think it would work. I'm like, how does this even work? It just doesn't make any sense. I understood the biology of it, but it just seems so hard. And then, a quick point is when we were in school, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but you couldn't just go somewhere to see these cases. You'd have to pull out a journal or go to the library. I mean, it just was not that easy to learn these techniques. And a lot of it was trial and error, and you would see these guys presenting at meetings, these just incredible cases, but they didn't really show you, what happens when the stuff goes bad or when you have complications. And so you start doing these procedures and you get some good, right results, but you're only as good as your last case. So you would go back and do another surgery where you think it was a home run. And next thing you know, the patient shows up, 3-4 days later and they got a massive infection. And, for me, it's always been about, predictability and efficiency and safety, obviously. And so I've just for the last maybe 6-7 years just been trying to figure out ways to perform these procedures and just try to make them as safe as possible. And, for my patient's benefit, but also for my benefit. So, I wouldn't, have a stroke because, I would lose sleep over these patients who would have, complications after surgery. So, we all have to feel comfortable with what we're doing. And like Israel mentioned, we both kind of have this thing where we're like, we really want to, we need to understand like the whole concept for us to really like feel comfortable doing something. So for the last couple of years, something that I've been doing is, a lot of guided bone regeneration. And I've tried to get away from using, resorbable, non-resorbable materials. I've been trying to get away from using tacks and screws because for me, they were just, a big pain. I've been getting a lot of success with different materials and just, basically playing around. And I always love on Instagram, people will ask me, well, why did you do it this way? Why didn't you do this? Maybe tomorrow I'll do it that way. Every single case is different. There's absolutely no cookbook. And there's also many ways to do every procedure. So, that's why Instagram is so great because we can all share cases. And I love, like lately, there's been a real trend amongst all of us sort of, post these soft tissue cases where there's a recession, and we all kind of try to figure out, you know, what we would do. And, you know, I can tell you every time now what Israel would do, you know, and because I've seen his success and I see what works in his hands so well. And for me, you know, we overlap. We all overlap a little bit, but there's also these extremes where, you know, some of us just feel more comfortable doing certain procedures than others. But yeah, I mean, to me, just it was always a passion to really want to get good at bone grafting and regeneration and kind of have that skill set. So it's sort of, you know, I spent time going to CE courses and reading Urban's book and, you know, hearing some of these, you know, world-class guys lecture, you know, that'll change your life. You know, just hearing it, you know, not reading in a book, but actually just seeing them and hearing them and having conversations with them. I remember being at a Starbucks in Boston a couple of years ago and Simeon Massimo was in front of me in line, you know? So I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, listen, you changed my life. Let me buy you a shot of espresso. And he got nicest guy in the world. And he sat and chatted with me for like 30 minutes. And, you know, he just changed my life again in those 30 minutes, just talking to him, you know, picking apart his brain, you know, his decision-making process on different cases. And you know, that's the sort of, you know,
mentorship. Yeah, that's what everybody needs. I mean, that's, you know, I love how you ended up with that influencers, you know, the mentor, having that the role model, somebody that you look up to, that you want to get better and better.
Yeah, what you said at the end there is like, honestly, what is the most important thing here? We both get DMs all the time about, hey, what material do you use? What material do you recommend? Why did you tuck it in that way? It's not about the materials at all. Like you said, you can do one technique one day, another technique another day, just because we feel like it. And for some reason, our gut tells us to use one versus the other. But it's not about the material. It's about knowing the thought process of why and much, much more. So that 30 minutes with Massimo Simeon and, you know, taking a course, a weekend course and talking to people and all things like that, that's what's most important. Not just learning about, okay, Matt likes Aussix Plus, therefore Aussix Plus is awesome and I'm going to use this. It's about learning what's in Matt's head and why he's doing it and how he's doing it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah, I mean, I always laugh too. You know, I think one big mistake, obviously, with you know, a lot of people that they'll view our photos, and you know, they don't realize it. You're blowing this tiny little square, you know, 3-inch area up into this huge screen. I mean, and I see things in my pictures. I just, if you go look at the post I made yesterday, or a couple days ago, it was like my typical suturing technique for the membrane. And I was sleeping during that surgery. I mean, my suture was a horizontal mattress and it went through the incision line. If you go back and look, and I had a bunch of DMs about it, and they're like, why did you do it this way? This is awesome. This is going to make it so much easier. Yeah, a new technique. And it was just a mistake, you know? And I mean, the patient healed okay, but if I had to do it again, I wouldn't have done it that way. It was a mistake. You know, you do a 1,000 surgeries. I mean, things are going to, every case is different. Some patients are very difficult to work on. You know, your head could be in the wrong place, or you're thinking about one thing and meanwhile you forget about, you know, something else. So, you know, we blow these pictures up and we sort of analyze and overanalyze, and people love to overanalyze. That's the other biggest question I always get is what bone graft material do you use and where do I get it from? To me, that's the least important, you know, because it's just a scaffold. No matter what we're using, it's just a scaffold, you know?
100%. I want to say this before we forget, or before I forget to mention, because I know I had the great pleasure of meeting you both here about a couple of weeks ago in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and they have started doing it's not a continuum yet. It's their separate it's a GBR course where, I don't know, what's the name of the title of that course that we went, it was GBR, something about GBR, right?
It's hands-on guided bone regeneration. And listen, that course was not, you know, both of us love teaching, but that course developed out of the need. You know, both of us were getting direct messages nonstop. When are you teaching a course?
Right.
And me and Israel had been, you know, communicating, you know, through Instagram. We became good friends, just, you know, emailing and text messaging back and forth. And we basically both, you know, messaged each other. We're like, listen, we got to talk on the phone because, you know, we're both getting these messages and, you know, maybe we have something to offer and we can, you know, kind of
What's funny is that I go to this course and I'm looking around. I'm like, dude, all these people are on Instagram. Like, they didn't even do any marketing. They didn't even do any marketing. Next thing you know, I'm going to this course. They sold out. How many people was it? 30?
So there's 25 people.
Yeah,
talk a little bit, because these are some of the good, actually very well surgeons out there. Crazy. And coming all the way from some from New York. I mean, I came from Nashville, that but it wasn't too far away. But still, like, the whole packed room did hands-on. We had pig jaws. We did some suturing. I mean, talk a little bit about what's your purpose of doing more with that, or where do you see this needs to go?
Yeah,
what
when's
you
the see? Next one?
Right.
When's so the next one, Israel?
What's that?
When's the next one?
Well, we are talking about it, and we have a tentative date set, but I got a review with the wife and the rest of the travel schedule for the year. But yeah, there's another one being planned, and there are a couple of things being planned right now. And I think there's going to be more of it because there's a desire. And like you said, like, we're constantly DM'd with a bunch of questions related to, come please give a lecture in Brazil, Australia, all of these things, and or teach a course right here in the US. And you know, we limited it to 20 people, I think, and we sold out in, what was it, like 8 or 9 days?
Yeah, and so we opened it up.
We barely marketed it. And then we have a really massive list of people who say they want in on the next one. And meanwhile, we think that we have to make it a bit smaller than we had last time. So it's gonna be interesting, but it's a good problem to have.
I love how you guys had all kinds of vendors, because that was also cool. I mean, think about it. At the end of the day, we are using their materials, right? Like, and I love the fact how you guys had the whole vendor group outside. I know, Blake, I want you to kind of put in as far as the regenerative world. I mean, you have a very good background as far as this whole
thing. That's where I started.
Right.
In this word
Tell
industry.
Us a little bit about this. Where is it going? And how did it, like, all, because you have a... Talk about your experience
with Bone Graft side. It's nonprofit, right? So you have a lot of nonprofits supplying an industry, and where it really comes from is it's a byproduct from making spinal disc and making different products from orthopedics and stuff like that. So dental's kind of the, hey, we have a few bags left over, and that's how Tissue Banks got into dental bone grafting, really. Mm-hmm. And now they're specialized in it. It's a different beast. You know, what you can charge in dental is a tenth of what you can charge in, you know, other, you know, orthopedics and spine and stuff. So I think that now they're getting more focused on it. It's becoming more specialized. I like companies like you guys had the Snow Oasis guys there at the course, and, you know, there's more biologic specific companies versus it being a commodity. So I think that's a good part of it.
Back in the day, like, it was more.
It was nonprofit, so they just weren't good at marketing. They didn't know what they were doing. Uh-huh. Like, it literally was. I've been at Tissue Banks, and literally it was bags of just shavings. It's like wood shavings, you know. And
chips.
They're like, used to call it the hot dog of you know, a bone graft.
Oh yeah,
you know, it was a leftover, and they said, we got all these shavings, we should sell it somewhere, and then they sell it in dental. And so you'll see a lot of Tissue Banks that come up and disappear because they're just trying to sell some inventory, and then they go away for a little while. But now there's been more companies focused on strictly biologics. And you know, I think these guys, it's fun watching them because I'm a biologics nerd. So I love watching guys who are really, you know, trying to push the boundaries and using unique products and combining everything and not just drinking the Kool-Aid of one brand and saying,
I mean,
this
look
is
at
it.
Matt. Matt's using some, he's using Aussix.
Yeah.
I mean, Aussix, which is it Datum? What's the company that...
Datum is the manufacturer.
Datum is
distributed by Orapharma and by Dentsply,
which is the same thing as Arestin. If you guys have ever used it, it's the same company. Yeah. And no tax. He's using strictly suture, horizontal mattress, some sling, and look at his result. All I have to say, just look at his result, because I was shocked. But I was like, how are you doing this without any tax?
Hey, Ray, I was shocked when I saw those results the first time.
And yeah, and that's what I'm like, dude, there's no way. And I'm going there and he's showing me. Then that's where I was like, man, this could be. I mean, the more I do it, I feel more comfortable, of course. But I mean, it was just very fascinating. And I love the fact that there are materials and vendors out there giving us that products that make us not hammer our patients in the head and being able to have the suture to do that for me, you know? How many times do you hear patients like, what did you do to my head?
And listen, we're all, you know, products of our own experiences. I mean, and I wanted to do the course, you know, secretly because I wanted to learn all of Israel's tricks. And, you know, he showed me there, you know, right before the conference, he showed me how he taxed his membranes, his non-resorbable membranes, and his bio guide. And, you know, I stole some tricks from him. So, you know, that suturing kind of developed that a necessity because I love the OSX membrane. I love the science behind it. And I was seeing good results, but I wanted to use it for bigger cases, but you just cannot tack or screw that membrane. It just will tear. So that really kind of developed as an experiment to say, well, let me just see if I can try the suturing technique that I read about. And it just sort of worked really well together with that membrane. And then I was able to do bigger cases. That's another important point, though. You know, a lot of people want to try these materials. And then, you know, the first time they use it, they say, oh, it tore on me or it ripped or it opened. Or, you know, you got to start with basic cases. You know, I can't tell you, at least a dozen people have sent me cases that they were very proud of themselves. And they sent me the pictures and they were trying to use it for these massive vertical, you know, GBR defects. And you know, you got to know your science and your chemistry, your biology. Because, I mean, if you go and look at most of my cases, most of them are horizontal defects. You know, they're in some cases, there's some, you know, component that's vertical, but for the most part, they're horizontal defects. And I didn't start doing severe horizontal defects. I started doing a lot of mild, a lot of moderate. And once I started getting the results, I said, okay, now I'll push it. You know, now I'll see if I can really, you know, contain a much larger defect. And so far it's been working pretty good, but you know, you got to start small. You can't just, you know, dive in head first, just like anything. You know, you want to get really good. That's why during our course, you know, one of the first things we do is suturing, right, Peyre?
We started with a very, very basic interrupted suture. Like that was just that. But then you could honestly going through the room and some of these people, you could still see even their basic interrupted suture, they still need a little bit of work, to be honest.
You wouldn't believe it walking through more than half and way more than half were suturing just a simple interrupted wrong.
And can't do that, then how are you going to get closure? Yeah, you're going to get primary closure on a GBR. So that's why we said, let's get suturing pads. And look, you know, Peyre, I walked over and he knew what he was doing. And a bunch of other guys knew what they were doing. I mean, so it wasn't the whole room, but that we knew that was going to be the case, right? Because these are things that everybody thinks they know, but there's ways to get more efficient. There's ways to be more effective. And you know, I wanted to start at the beginning because I knew that was going to, you know, be a huge factor in really. As we're speaking, I have somebody who came to my first conference that we did in May sending me pictures of his just tumors of bone that he's grown, you know, using the technique. So
that is awesome.
That's pretty
sick. Isn't that the sweetest thing that you ever get when somebody's sending you something after the course? Like, hey, thank you. And you feel like you had actually something to do with it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why we do it. Me and Israel, we're both wet finger dentists. I mean, we go to work. I work a little harder than him. I think I'm working 5.5 days a week.
Oh my gosh, you are working way too much.
He does. But,
I work psychologically harder than he does.
But, you know, we've
got kids.
We're both in the trenches. We're not, you know, we don't make we're not making our living off of teaching. Where we did it for fun. It was sort of an experiment and we both loved it and we both learned from it, you know.
But if you really think about it, I think if you guys really just put your time do more teaching.
Well, let me tell you though.
Let me tell you how much money there is in teaching.
Well, my back is hurting me now, so
No, this is what. No, the reason I said this is because of the desire. The desire and motivation that I'm seeing in a lot of millennials are so much far than it is and a lot of people think it is because everybody think like they want it and they but no, honestly, I'm getting so many DMs from younger dentists in dental school, D1s, D2s, D3s even, and they are so excited to get out and conquer the world. Like they're like, they want to learn so much. And this is not how I was back here. I mean, I really honestly didn't know what I was doing either. I mean, but when I'm seeing these kids are just so motivated, it makes me want to be able to give them back more. So for example, when you said some of these things about these people not even knowing, or some of the folks not knowing the basics of just the suturing, for example, it's not, they really want to learn and look at them driving. But the thing is that there's lack of education out there for a lot of these stuff.
Even on the basics, though, like when you talk about suturing, I mean, that is actually a major problem. I mean, I was out at that course with Joe Marinfar at Brighter Way.
That's another one.
And you were watching guided single implant cases take all day.
Yeah.
Because suturing was an issue.
10-minute implant placement, hour-long suturing.
Yeah, yeah, 2-hour-long. I mean, it was a struggle. It just was awkward for them. And you know, I think, yeah, I've seen even oral surgeons, I'm probably going to kill me, but who, you know, a set of thirds, maybe take 6 sets of sutures. You know, it's just, they're out here by their, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Exactly. You know, I think that was a big thing. When I talk, people always want to do crazy cases on the app and live streaming, and I'm like, you know, what I really want to see too is some basic stuff. I mean, just what's on your tray for basic extraction, instrument knowledge, and stuff like that. I mean, I see all the time. People,
I think more
don't
of these companies really need to start sponsoring. Like, for example, I know it's hard to get out of your practice, your daily thing, and try to teach other folks, but if you think about it, if more of these companies start realizing, quit thinking about these conventions and think about influencers. Yeah. Think about micro influencers, not the 100,000 followers where they're showing before or after cosmetic supermodels. That's not what I want to see.
No,
I want to see your case. I want to see how I get to that result. Not show me some, like I said, these fancy looking girls with things on their faces. I don't want to
see
that.
Selfie
about
account.
We talk about this with the, like the podcast all stuff. It's like at the end of the day, like y'all get this. If when people are DMing you, if you tell them, "Hey, I've used this and it works great," they're getting it. Like there's no there's no if and buts, whatever. Like if Payray calls me or if I call him, like, "Hey, what did you use to do that?" Like, I'll just buy it. Like, there's no like. Like it's immediate, like
we used to
because
brand.
You trust me and I trust you know how I care about you. I'm not gonna tell you like go buy this because I'm gonna get points from it.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna get flying,
but I would like you to get some
brands would
get flying sometimes.
Brands would usually make the KOLs, right? Like they dictated who would be a KOL and who wouldn't be. And now it's changing with guys like y'all and making your own brand and working with multiple products. You know, used to you had to drink the Kool-Aid and be through and through one company, one thing,
right.
and they put you on the podium. That's you work for them, and that's now you guys are working for yourself and doing it.
Because that's not how we practice, you know?
No, you're exactly right.
I mean, I say this, and I should say this even with Soli, because I mean, he doesn't talk about it much on the podcast, but when I see his impact on a lot of younger dentists understanding the concept of 3D and how much he's trying to push it out there, they're like, guys, you need to get the 3. You got to get in your mind. We don't talk about it, but that really makes it. That makes so much sense for some of these people to start looking at your cases, even after your simple root canals. Just learn from it, you know.
You've all disrupted the model of way that KOL was and education. Everybody's finding their own little niche, and it's awesome because then everybody has their own little small category, and
it's a win-win for everybody. Think about it. I mean, they do more in these little courses, they can sell more than going to these Hinman, for example, trying to sell, I don't know, kids. Nobody's gonna buy kids from there. But if they call you guys and they're like, hey, they're gonna start ordering all these membranes. Like, and look at me, I ordered $2,000 phone.
You know, we're trusted because we you know, even in our course, the vendors that we had, we approached them. We didn't allow vendors to approach us. And I think DIA did the same thing. We approached the vendors that we work with, that we like, and that we know.
Yeah, they're more like partners.
Know the product like the back of our hand. And, you know, there's a fine line between that and what you're saying about, you know, companies pushing products onto us to be able to show to everybody. Matt and I, obviously, we won't do that just to explore with random products because that takes away from the authenticity of it. And with social media, it's really all about authenticity. We're putting, you know, I'm putting myself, Matt's putting himself, you guys are putting yourselves as a real full total person out there. And it's all about authenticity when it comes to social media. And we've got to show what we really know rather than just for the money.
Okay. Last question then, or my last question essentially
is this thing live?
No, we're not live.
No, I'm saying whenever they listen to it, they're probably listening in the car driving to work or coming from work.
Or on a lawnmower. The south mowing grass.
Or mowing grass. Oh, actually, that's common.
True. It's very common.
I get a lot of those mowing pictures. There's a mowing picture with the podcast.
What's your one tip that you would go back and give young Matt and young Israel graduating from residency?
For me, it's, you know, get out of the cave. You know, I love going to meetings, but we all kind of get busy. And we, you know, for the first couple of years after residency, I was really in a cave. I burned myself out. So I think, you know, continue to learn and go to these meetings and do hands-on and stay, you know, keep up to date, because very quickly, if you think you're up to date, the second you kind of take it for granted, you know, you'll be, you know, a caveman very quickly.
Yeah.
Don't be a caveman.
I'm excited to meet him at DIA for sure.
DIA, baby. Ezra, what do you got?
For me, I think it's really just go with your gut. You know, make what you want right from day one. There's so many times where you say, you know, people graduating, they got to take some insurance and then eventually they'll work out of it. It's really tough to work out of it when you are taking it, when that's your lifeblood. It's really tough to work out of it. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, to some degree what I did and to some degree what I didn't do, but you really got to build what you want from the beginning. And if you do it the right way, then you're going to be a success. And if you learn the right things, then you're going to be a success. Learn from your mistakes, but start from day one with the end goal in mind and act on it right away.
That's good.
That's a good one.
Blake, you got anything to add?
I'm fine also. End goal in mind.
End goal in mind.
End goal in mind. He said something else that I want to mention. He said something very interesting that was authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
That's very
good. You guys are bringing integrity back to dentistry, though. I think a lot of guys...
What about sexy?
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know, maybe. A little bit. Sully is. With his hot tub live streams.
Yeah, my hot tub live streams.
You still do those?
Oh, yeah, man. Dude,
I haven't gone on Facebook.
Hot tub is where I come up with my best
thinking. I haven't gone on Facebook in such a long... I need to get back on the Facebook group.
The Facebook groups are good, though, too. You know, there's some good Facebook groups on there.
I know, man. Facebook groups are good. Like, you learn a lot. But just reading some comments...
The rabbit holes, though.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
I feel like actually Instagram, that sounds so funny to say it this way, but I feel like Instagram has there's like a level of I don't know, it keeps away some
people get vicious on Facebook, yeah, too. Like, oh my gosh, there's an implant one. Someone posted a full arch case the other day.
I completely agree. I think Instagram, it's a different level of communication. I mean, Facebook, people just criticize without, you know,
it's just daggers, man. I think it's more exposed. Like, there's no privacy on Facebook. It's kind of like you're naked out. Everybody's looking around and like, oh my God,
I think the difference is people are looking to freaking throw daggers.
There are some, of course, yeah. There are some
people who are just freaking sniping
that are very bored at work because they don't have enough patience.
Yeah.
And they just get on people and start arguing about 30 people. Stuff.
And yeah, there's not a lot of overlap either. They're either on Facebook or Instagram, though, it seems like. It doesn't seem like they're very active on Instagram if they are in the Facebook group.
That's true.
And that may
but the thing about Instagram I love is like, if you don't like it, just block me and just don't follow me, right? And if you like me, just follow me and they don't have to say anything. But at the end of the day, Facebook is not the same thing, because you're going to be in the group where if you're going to say something, you better get ready, because how many people are going to be jumping on you?
Mm-hmm.
Good times.
So true.
Well, that's Docs, good, man.
Thank y'all so much for joining us.
I got my weekly dose of Millennial Dentist podcast.
I've been so glad to be back on a regular routine.
Yes.
I've missed this.
We're going to have Nacho Man next week.
Speaking of Facebook.
Yes.
Not the Nacho Man, Paul Goodman.
See, we're not biased. We're going to have some Facebook popular people on. Nacho Man's going to be on next week. So,
hey, Matt.
Nacho Man.
Paul Goodman.
He's got a very good following on Facebook.
He has a Facebook group called Dental Nachos.
Dental Nachos.
Dental Nachos, really?
And nice. It's got a big group.
It's kind of like Dental Nuggets.
Pretty active group.
Yeah. Kinda, yeah. You get a lot of pearls. And he's got his own podcast.
Yep.
He's got a podcast.
I don't know if he does or not.
I don't know.
Maybe. I think everybody's got a podcast now.
I know.
We're trendsetters.
You started it.
Trendsetters.
You started the way.
All right, everybody. Thank you all again for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
We'll see you next time.
Thanks for letting me join.
Let's work smarter, not harder.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.